I was filled with an enormous love for everything that had ever happened to me, with an especially great, perfectly satisfied love for the events of the past several weeks, and with an almost ecstatic sense of expectation for what lay ahead. I was about to land in the promised land, after which nothing else mattered, after which everything would take care of itself. But not finally after all.
Welcome to Season 2 of The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. Today, we'll be reading Nerves by Yosef Chaim Brenner. This season of the podcast is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
Our story today, Nerves, by Yosef Chaim Brenner, was published a year after the author's arrival in Palestine in 1909 as part of the Second Aliyah. That term describes those Jews who came to settle in the land of Israel in the decade 1904 to 1914. Their predecessors in the First Aliyah had arrived between 1882 and 1904 and mostly formed such agricultural settlements as Rishon LeZion, Rosh Pina, and Zichron Yaakov. In its makeup, this second wave of some 35,000 settlers was more intellectual and ideological, including such figures as David Ben-Gurion, the future leader of the state, and the great writer Shai Agnon, whom we'll be reading later on in our series. This same cohort established the city of Tel Aviv, the Bezalel Academy of Arts and Design, a number of Hebrew high schools and literary journals, and also Degania, the first kibbutz. In addition, as part of their dedication to reestablishing an independent Jewish homeland, they began speaking Hebrew rather than their native Yiddish. Even so, the majority of the newcomers failed to withstand the difficulties they faced and soon returned to Russia or moved on to Britain or America. Zionism was apparently easier in word than in deed. Brenner was one of those who stayed. As already a well-known Hebrew writer and editor, his very presence in Palestine helped make it the creative center of the emerging Hebrew Renaissance. Moreover, he was personally much admired for his ascetic personal life and his wholehearted dedication to literature, which gave him an aura of moral leadership comparable to that of the rabbis of the yeshivas in which he had studied in his youth. His reputation for saintliness grew posthumously when, after only a little more than a decade since his arrival, he was murdered during the Arab riots of 1921, having refused to leave his fellow Jews at their small outpost near Tel Aviv. His writing, however, presents more of a paradox. It downplays the Zionist accomplishment. Explicit preachers of Zionism, religious and secular alike, fare very badly in Brenner's fiction. In general, he cultivates distrust of ideological hyperbole and nationalist hubris. And yet, this habitual understatement of his made him the most beloved writer of the Yishuv, the Jewish community of Palestine. Perhaps this story can help us understand why and how less can sometimes be more. Atzabim, nerves, here translated by Hillel Halkin, is situated in one of the small Jewish colonies that had been established by members of the First Aliyah in 1885. It is evening, and two men are out walking, although they don't go far because one of them has a bandaged foot. Our narrator, the longer-time resident of the two, is patiently protective of the other, a newcomer to the colony, who has contracted malaria and is still weakened by illness. When they stop for a rest, the younger man, who seems to have been waiting for such an opportunity, unburdens himself of the story of how he had come on Aliyah a year and a half earlier. His account covers the inner eight of the story's 10 chapters. Well, as they set out on their stroll, the main narrator, whom in shorthand I will call the colonist, enjoys the perfume-like smell of the acacia trees and gives a lyrical description of the golden shaft from the setting sun at our backs. He takes pleasure in everything, knowing how much effort has gone into planting these trees and building the colony. A bird, whose Hebrew name neither of us knew, flew brilliantly by, flashing green against the blue sky, and disappeared. If their Hebrew has not yet gotten around to naming this bird, he is confident that it soon will. As for the younger man, he is described by his companion as an ordinary-looking man of about 30, with a set of strong, sloping shoulders and a coarse-featured, acne-studied face. Because he was ill, he had not gone to work this September day. Whereas the colonist takes pleasure in their surrounding, the younger man, looking back at the village, comments on the quivering of its still too few treetops. "Why quivering?" asks the colonist. The newcomer explains that the trees, no older than the village itself, can remember when there was nothing here at all. The treetops can see cities in the distance that stand on very solid ground, and this must make them aware of their own fragility. "My heart goes out," he says, "to anything that is forced to put forth branches before it has time to strike root." Each man thus interprets his surroundings according to his own state of mind, and what a contrast between the two. The earlier settler is already at home and is making it a home for others, whereas the newcomer attributes to the young trees his own difficulty in striking roots in the land of Israel. He is a bundle of nerves. "Stay a while longer," the younger man urges when they sit down to rest at the edge of the village. He apologizes for having a hard time getting started in telling his story. You see, I'm over it now. I'll get over this rambling, too. One gets over it all in the end." But he never does stop rambling. And though I will not try to imitate his speech, readers of the story may find their patience tried by the hesitations, qualifications, interruptions, philosophic digressions, and requests for assurance that punctuate his narrative from start to finish. State of mind is conveyed through the pattern of speech, and his, shall we say, is unstable. "Well, I had decided to come to Palestine. Why? For what? What did I think might happen here? That's all beside the point." The newcomer begins his story at the point of his departure from New York. An immigrant to America from Ukraine, he had worked for 8 years in a button factory, about which he says, "I can't imagine a more disgusting place or job." America, then in 1910, a beacon of the largest Jewish immigration in history, is for him merely the launching pad for a journey to something better. But what? He doesn't even claim to be a Zionist. He still doubts that there is any meaning to be had in life, including in picking oranges in the land of Israel. Yet without knowing exactly what drove him to it, he set out from New York for the promised land. His first stop, he continues, was London, where Brenner himself had spent a couple of years before coming to Palestine. One night, a refugee in the rooming house where he was staying committed suicide by inhaling gas. This man had managed to smuggle himself into England, but his wife and family were shipped back to Europe, and he had taken his life out of despair at being unable to help them. Our young traveler could not get this incident out of his mind. So on the second stage of his journey, by train across Europe, he comes across a woman traveling with her 5 children and a younger sister, but without a husband, and he is convinced that this must be the suicide's family. The 2 women, irritated by his attempts to establish their identity, turn out to be not from the dead man's city, and definitely not his relatives. But, he says, "I had already gone too far in my fantasy that this was the same family that had been turned back from the English shores, and whose father had arrived at the one true shore, to abandon it now." The fact that the cities weren't the same, that this family was traveling with an aunt whereas the other one wasn't, made no impression on me. An embarrassed, ambiguous pity, is there any pity worse than that, welled up for them inside me. Now, someone else in his place might have described his embarrassed, ambiguous pity as simple empathy and taken pride in helping this family, as in fact he then does, all the way to their eventual landing in Haifa. But our young man can never allow himself the luxury of self-approval, instead attributing his behavior to, again, his nerves. And the colonist, listening to the story, agrees, a very Jewish case of nerves. The tale is not nearly done. As the not entirely trusted escort of this refugee family, our anxious hero experiences all the hardships that he could have avoided were he on his own. The stopover in Berlin, where the mother has to ask for aid from the local Jewish charity to pay for the rest of the family's trip. The ships crossing from Trieste to Alexandria, where they have to take a train to Port Said to board yet another steamer to take them to Jaffa. At each point of transit, there is baggage to be moved, currency exchanged, officials bribed or persuaded, opportunities for every kind of dishonesty. Among the main difficulties of the journey is not being able to know whom to trust. In brief, the intersecting journeys of the single traveler and the fatherless family encapsulates all the hardships and insecurities of getting to the land of Israel. An uprooted people, or a people reorienting itself, is no longer in possession of firm guidelines, and it is not only non-Jews of whom one must be wary. The return to Zion has been made even more hazardous because the behavior of fellow Jews is no more reliable or detectable than that of Gentiles. Have you ever paid attention to the faces of some of our predatory Jews who haunt the cities of the Orient? I mean those cocky, energetic, wolfish ones with their oily black hair and their sharp little mustaches that curl up at the edges. Have you noticed how they prowl when they walk as though stalking prey? I tell you, one can spot at a glance which of them are merely pickpockets and sharks, and which also deal in human flesh. And as soon as the person in question boarded the ship, I assure you, an agreeable, pleasant person to look at, and ran his eyes softly over the daughter of the family, I knew in exactly which category to place him. The insecurity and danger grow at every juncture. During the interval in Alexandria, the family is fleeced by associates of a bellhop who declares himself a Zionist, eager to help those bound for Palestine. At Port Said, later, however, a young man helps them all to board their ship and refuses payment. Though our traveler distrusts this altruism, the young man explains, I only wanted to do my human duty. Halkin renders this in secular terms, but the Hebrew explanation, I wanted my mitzvah to be complete, speaks for someone who performs good deeds as his Jewish obligation. So while trust is sometimes a decoy for dishonesty, it may also prove to be a Jewish devotion, and there is no sure way of telling one from the other. Finally, as the travelers approach the shore of Jaffa, our traveler's nervous tension gives way to a burst of joy. Suddenly, I was filled with an enormous love for everything that had ever happened to me, with an especially great, perfectly satisfied love for the events of the past several weeks, and with an almost ecstatic sense of expectation for what lay ahead. I was about to land in the promised land, after which nothing else mattered, after which everything would take care of itself. But not finally after all. The excessive swing from dejection to elation is soon punctured by the realization that he wasn't even intending to debark in Jaffa. And this is just as well, because local regulations do not allow the family he is accompanying to go ashore there, so they are still with him the rest of the way to Haifa. After that emotional buildup, he has not yet arrived. And note, the promised land actually turns back some of those who need its shelter, not unlike England at the start of this journey. We also know that everything had not taken care of itself once he gets to the colony. This false rapture, which is also a letdown for the reader, reinforces the story's preference for modest expectations, for tempered realism over romantic idealism when it comes to Zionism and to life itself. At the actual anticlimactic landing in Haifa, our traveler and the family disembark haphazardly, with people in the harbor shouting conflicting instructions about whether a visa or payment is needed, but he can't hold back. I saw the Russian woman with her children drawing nearer to the shore, with an insane look of excitement on her face, coupled with the refusal to believe that she was actually safe. I saw Jews, who looked much the same as Jews elsewhere, standing on the soil of the Holy Land, the land I had dreamed of since I was a boy. I saw the pure blue waters of the bay as they rose, fell, broke away from faraway worlds upon this promised shore. This shore that made me think of the Jew in London who had come to that other shore. It was too much for me. The emotional dam finally bursts, and to the amusement of onlookers, our traveler dissolves in tears. Could telling this story be the catharsis the traveler needed to free himself from the burdens of exile? If this is not quite what the pioneers had in mind when they sang, "Anu Banu Artsa, we came to this land to build and be rebuilt by it," it was undeniably part of the return. The traveler himself doesn't know quite how to evaluate his experience. Both he and the veteran colonist presumably shun inflated rhetoric. Both of us, he says, hate all those empty words about beauty that are bandied around night and day. That kind of buildup even tempts us to deny the existence of beauty altogether. At the same time, he admits that he did feel the great beauty of the Haifa Bay that day. I really did believe in beauty then, of nature, of the cosmos, of something even higher than that. But then he feels obliged to add, of course, that too was only nerves. As if he were saying, don't expect me to say the blessing of Shehechionu on arriving in the land of our fathers. Well, this then is vintage Brenner, chronicler of the Second Aliyah, who voices the cautionary skepticism of a people too often disappointed and fears the evil eye for celebrating prematurely. Franz Kafka was already terminally ill in a TB sanatorium in Prague when he read Brenner. He was studying Hebrew and hoping to immigrate to the land of Israel, and he asked, "What's this? Pessimism in Palestine?" He had expected something more robust from its pioneers. Well, the Israeli literary scholar Boaz Arpali calls this not pessimism, but the negative principle that makes the most trustworthy Zionist the one least willing to affirm the messianic qualities of Aliyah. Brenner is honest and believable because he is so far from claiming that Aliyah brings salvation. According to this view of literature and life, the more the negative principle of reality is included in a narrative, the more reliable it becomes. We must remember, though, that the traveler's story is enclosed within the surrounding actuality of the colony that has taken in the young man and that may help nurse him back to health. The story ends with the colonist accompanying the newcomer back to his inn, where the innkeeper's daughter is studying French and her brother is planning to move to America. If the diaspora Jew may still be traumatized, the homegrown locals may already be looking for a better life abroad. The colonist has little use for those sitting around the table eating pickled herring, the image with which he ends his story. Who knows? Maybe he has adduced the newcomer's saga as an antidote to the locals' incipient bourgeois self-satisfaction. And there is also something else. Heading home, The colonist tells us, quote, "The dark alleyway beyond the synagogue was deserted, a glancing reminder that this is the month of Elul, the season when Jews give an accounting of their soul." This would have been in the minds of Hebrew readers from the start, when the colonist refers to September, which in Hebrew he refers to as Elul. Brenner's contemporaries would have realized that back in the European Jewish enclaves they left behind, the area around the synagogue would then have been alive with people. Most of the new Hebrew writers of the Yishuv did not use religious vocabulary or observe halachic tradition. Explicit preachers of Zionism, religious and otherwise, fare very badly in Brenner's fiction, as we have said. But just as soldiers in the trenches often resent the propagandists back home who have to sell the war to the public, the pioneers appreciated Brenner for providing this corrective to the forcibly optimistic anthems and exhortations of Zionism's official proponents. His portrayal of their hardships had for them the feel of truth. It took nerve to match the high ideals of national liberation to the tough realities of restoring a dispersed people. Brenner had the nerve. He also knew the anxiety, the nerves, that fueled the courage to continue and to complete the mission. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, we will be reading Jacob Glatstein's poem, Without Jews. And for now, happy reading.